We're all set. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our last brown bag seminar of the semester. We'll be getting started back in January with Patrick Vitale, but today we're happy to welcome back to Uxer and back to Pitt, and back to Pittsburgh, Andrew Oren, who is the Vice President of Research at the National Low Income Housing Coalition. And lots of you know Andrew, and we're happy to see you. He joined the National Low Income Housing Coalition in July of last year as Vice President for Research and was previously a faculty member at the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at Florida State, where he taught graduate courses in housing policy, community development, and research methods, and completed research on the impacts of comprehensive planning and land use and supply of affordable housing for low-income households. Andrew was already a long-standing member of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, so his work really goes back quite a few years before actually taking the position. In addition, he was co-PI of the survey research project regarding the residential environments of older adults and worked as the research division in Montgomery County, Maryland, Planning Department. He was also a postdoc research associate at the Taubman Center for Public Policy and American Institutions at Brown University. And when he was here at Pittsburgh, at Pitt, he completed his PhD in GISPIA with his dissertation in Smart Growth, Smart for Low-Income Households, a study of the impact of four smart growth principles on the supply of affordable housing. Andrew also came to me. He was a Bucknell graduate and worked in a School of Social Work, recent graduate and a community organizer, and just got to GISPIA as a doctoral student and came in with a resume in hand looking for some jobs, and I said, come back in a couple of days. We're waiting to hear about this HUD grant, the Community Outreach Partnership Center. I think pretty much when Andrew left, I got an email and with advance notice from our political representative that we indeed did get a Community Outreach Partnership Center. Tracy Sosco was my co-director with that, so he met Andrew pretty much from day one. And Andrew, earlier this fall, as you know, we had Sung Soo Wang here. I think a lot of the beginning of UXER's data work of the recent era began with you and Sung Soo walking around South Oakland and Hazelwood, pen in hand, taking data back, putting in an Excel spreadsheet, and doing some GIS mapping. Of course, now the data capabilities are quite a bit more extensive. But we welcome you back to Pitt. We welcome you back to UXER, though we're in a different building. You've already seen a lot of the staff that were here then, and glad to see you.
Great, thanks. Yeah, it's great to be back here. That sort of makes me think that so when Sung Soo and I were walking around neighborhoods looking at the housing stock while collecting data from the city and doing all this work, that it occurs to me that what took us months to do, now with everything online and so easily available, it probably takes someone now weeks to do. Like, it's amazing how things have changed in 10 years. So I prepared a presentation today with the thought in mind that there probably would be a diverse group of people here, and it turns out there are a diverse group of people here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk first a little bit about the coalition and what we do and how we're organized and structured, because some people may not be familiar with the coalition. Then that'll lead me to talk about housing affordability and what we focus on, affordability for extremely low income or the poorest renters in the country. And then that will lead me in to talk about some policy issues, specifically the National Housing Trust Fund, which is being funded for the first time, where money will be distributed hopefully next summer for. And so I'll talk about those three things. And I know some of you are familiar with some of these things and some of you are not, but I wanna sort of address everyone here. So the coalition is a national organization. We focus on federal policy, and we focus specifically on federal policy that benefits extremely low, people with the lowest incomes, and our definition of that is people with extremely low income, which is 30% of the year median income. So in Pittsburgh, that's 20,000 for a family of four, $20,910, how we define it. And that's what we focus on, and how best to address their housing needs. The way we're set up is there's really three teams within the coalition. There's a field team, there's a policy team, and there's a research team. I'm able to talk quite a bit about our research. I can talk some about, you know, the policies and our policy stances we take at the federal level. But we have other policy people who can speak much more about that. How we're organized, we truly are a coalition of many different organizations throughout the country, some national organizations and state level organizations. Some of our members that we have, it's a membership organization. We have 67 state coalition partners. So there's 67 organizations around the country that are state coalitions. Some states have more than one housing coalition. So for an example, in California, there's a housing coalition that focuses on urban housing issues, and there's a separate organization that focuses on rural housing. California. So some states have two, some states have none. So like Idaho, Iowa, North Dakota, they don't have a housing coalition. They're our partners. Then we also have organizational members, large national organizations such as like community development corporations, some public housing agencies as well. And then we also have individual members. We have about 855 members. But most importantly, we have a great advocacy network, and so we have a number of people that we contact, a number of advocates that help us out who aren't necessarily members, but they're supportive of us. And our database includes more than 27,000 advocates around the country. So when we send out an email about what's going on Capitol Hill, and please alert Congress people, we send it to a huge batch of people, more than 27,000 people or organization it goes through. So that's what our field team does. We have a separate policy team that focuses solely on dealing with congressional staffers on Capitol Hill. And we have three main policy goals. One is to preserve the affordable housing for extremely low income that already exists. The other one is to expand the supply of affordable housing. And the other one is to advocate for policies that create housing stability, so permanent housing. And we strongly feel that extremely low-income households should be able, there should be adequate housing, that they should be able to choose whether they want to move to somewhere or stay in their current community. That's the policy team. And I'm part of the research team. And basically what we do is we have three primary tasks. And the first primary task is to document the need for our policy team and for our field team and for other advocates. All of the work we do, we drill it down to the congressional district level, because it's very important for our policy team to be able to go to congressmen of the 14th District of Pennsylvania and say, look, we have clearly documented need for 27,000 additional rental units for extremely low-income renters, and because you need these 27,000 units, it's why like 69% of these renters are spending more than half of their income on rent. That's the 14th District, Congressional District of Pennsylvania. So it's important for our policy team to be able to go to do that for every district when they go to the meetings on Capitol Hill. So we inform that. We also do research that informs our policy stances. So we just recently completed a study about low-income housing tax credits and how developers use them to provide housing for extremely low-income renters. And the results of that study changed our policy stances. And what we would support in terms of changing some requirements of the tax credits. We also do that type of research as well. It informs our policy agenda. So that's a little bit about the coalition. And I'm going to talk also a little bit about housing affordability in general. One of the things that the coalition produces every year, which is widely cited by advocates, by developers, by the media, and that is our out-of-reach report, which just looks at housability. Housing affordability in general, right?
I like it.
And basically, it's what we call the housing wage. And we develop it for every state, every metropolitan area, and every county in the country. And what it is how much can a person, how much does a person have to earn in order to afford a two-bedroom apartment? And so, you know, we can just look at the map and say, you know, in Pennsylvania, on average, someone has to earn $17.57 an hour to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment, a modest two-bedroom apartment that rents at fair market rent. And as many of you know, the fair market rent typically is the 40th percentile of rents that someone who's moving in their area could expect to pay. So it's the lower end of the market. These are not, you know, it's not $17 an hour for a high-end unit. It's for a pretty modest unit. The states in dark blue are all over $20 an hour. You're not going to be surprised by any of those states. California, Hawaii, D.C., New York, Washington State. Or someone has to earn more than $20 an hour to afford a one-bedroom apartment. And this gets a lot of attention, I think, because, you know, people can identify with this. You know, when you go to speak to a general audience and you start to talk about area median incomes, and very low-income households are 50% of area median income, and extremely low-income households are 30% of area median income, non-housing people sometimes sort of, like, lose track of what that all means. But what everybody understands is when you say you have to earn $17 an hour to afford an apartment in Pennsylvania, right? And then the other thing, because we're concerned that the coalition about extremely low income renters. Sorry, you had your.
I didn't know if we were taking questions.
We
can wait.
Yeah.
If you've got a clarifying question but no discussion question.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I was just going to say, is the number skewed because of Philadelphia?
Oh,
yeah.
That's
so
a good question.
So let me explain this a bit. So HUD publishes fair market rents for non-metropolitan counties and for metropolitan areas. So when we report the housing wage for counties or for the metropolitan areas based on the fair market rent. For the state, this is a weighted average.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at Philadelphia, it's a little bit more than, it's around $20 an hour. And when you look at Pittsburgh, it's about $12. It's $15.12 an hour. So yeah, so it's a little higher because of the Philadelphia area. That's a good question. Yeah. So what we also look at is, because we're concerned about the lowest income renters, is how many hours would someone have to work in order to afford a one-bedroom apartment? And just for a one-bedroom apartment in Pennsylvania, on average, someone would have to work 78 hours a week at minimum wage in order to afford a one-bedroom apartment. In no area in the country does the minimum wage allow someone to afford a one-bedroom apartment.
Wow.
If they're working 40 hours a week. Nowhere. And in D.C., where I live, a minimum wage worker, and they have a higher minimum wage, is $100 or 100 hours a week someone has to work to afford a one-bedroom apartment. And then the other thing I just want to mention about housing affordability is when we talk about these low wages, who house these low wages, based on the fair market rents in Pittsburgh, someone would have to earn an annual salary of $25,200 to afford a one-bedroom apartment rented at the fair market rent in the Pittsburgh region. It's about, the fair market rent, it's $630 a month, right? And then someone would have to earn $31,440 if they needed a two-bedroom apartment at fair market rent. And you can see here there are some occupations. If you look at the red lines, those are the, starting from the bottom to top, the one-bedroom wage is in red, the two-bedroom wage is the second one in red, and the three-bedroom wage. You'll see that people who are working full-time, the median wages of people working full-time in food preparation and food service, as well as in personal care services, so people who are taking care of your grandmother and serving your food, they don't earn enough working, you know, the median worker does not earn enough money for a full-time, or does not earn enough for a one-bedroom apartment. And then one other thing I want to mention before we get into cost burdens is that also as part of our out-of-reach report, we look at what different groups of people could afford to pay in rent. And if you look at the bottom here, start from the bottom, the rent that's affordable to someone who's on SSI disability is $227 a month. That's 30% of what their SSI benefits are each month, which is $733. Someone who's working full-time at the minimum wage can afford to pay $377 a month. Mm-hmm. And you'll see up here, the one-bedroom fair market rent is $630. And so this is really the group of people that, at the coalition, that we are very much concerned about. Not surprisingly then, of course, because they have such low incomes and they can afford so little rent, they are much more likely to be cost burdened. These are the percentage of households in different income groups that are cost burdened or severely cost burdened. HUD has a standard that, you know, a household, if they're spending more than 30% of their income on housing, is cost burdened, more than 50%, they're severely cost burdened. And there's this, you'll often read in the media these days, nationally, you often see reports, oh, half the renter population in the U.S. is spending more than half of their income on housing. Oh, half of the population, half of the renters are spending more than 30% of their income. And a quarter of renters are spending half of their income on housing nationally. But that kind of covers up the groups that are really have a significant problem in terms of cost burdens. And so I put this up not for nationally, but for the Pittsburgh region. If you look at extremely low-income households, 69% are severely cost-burdened, right? If you look at moderate-income households that we say earn between 80 to 120%, only 1% of them are severely cost-burdened. So it's very important to look at what groups are you talking about when you're talking about cost burdens, rather than just, half of the renter population is cost-burdened, right? Or a quarter of the population is severely cost-burdened. The question becomes, who is cost-burdened? And it's not, and if you're wondering, I put this up here too, you know, if you don't work in housing, you want to know what these income limits are. In Pittsburgh, you're extremely low income if you're a family of four and you earn less than $20,000, $20,910. If you're a family of two or household of two, you're extremely low income if your income is less than $16,730. So that just gives you some sense of what incomes we're talking about.
Are you able to look at the racial disparity?
Not in this presentation, no.
You don't have the data to be able to tease
apart. No. Although that's a good, we can, in the discussion, we can talk about that because we're actually in the middle of writing a paper, a report about that. We're looking at cost burdens by race by income.
Does your cost burden assessment for taking into account those who are receiving assistance already so that they would not consider cost burdens even if they're not?
They would not be considered cost burden.
Right.
Is that,
so you
right.
account for that.
Sorry?
You account for that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And actually, I will mention, I'll quickly answer your question very quickly, because it is a question about income. And that is, so if you look at cost burdens nationally by race, you'll see that Hispanics and African American renters are much more likely to be cost burdened than white renters. But when you break it down by income groups, when you're extremely low income, there is no difference by race. It doesn't matter, you know, everyone, or regardless of the group, people who are extremely low income are very highly likely to be cost burdened and severely cost burdened. And race does not play as much of an issue. But it plays an issue when you look at the fact that Hispanic population and African American population, one, are more likely to be renters, and two, are more likely to be extremely low income renters. So part of the explanation for these cost burdens, of course, is income. That's the income side, and then the other side is the housing side, right? And there's clearly, you know, not surprisingly, a shortage of affordable housing for these extremely low-income households. I'm just going to quickly mention this, because this is really the area that the coalition is, I mean, this is the reason for our existence, is this shortage. There's almost 91,000 extremely low-income renters in the Pittsburgh region. There's about 64,000, almost 65,000 units that would be affordable to them. But, you know, we're talking about the private market, so, you know, you don't control who lives in what unit. So many of these units are occupied by higher-income households, right? So there's actually only close to 36,000 units are actually affordable and available to them. So that's a shortage of about 55,000 units that are affordable and available to extremely low-income households. If you expand that out a bit and say, well, let's not look at just extremely low-income households, let's look at extremely low-income and very low-income households, so households that make up to half of the median income, which is this graph, you'll see that we have close to 141,000 renters who are extremely low-income and very low-income, but there's 181,000, close to 182,000 units that are affordable to them. And the reason why that number of units affordable to them increases so much is that there's a lot more units that are affordable between the 30 and 50% range, particularly when you get close to that 50% of AMI, very median income. They can afford a lot more units. There's still a shortage in the number that are affordable and available, because many of these units, about 70,000, are occupied by higher income households, right? And this is a graph I'm going to explain a little bit. This is something we put into our gap analysis report that we do every year. If you look at the right-hand column, the bottom group, 90,913, that's the number of extremely low-income renters in the region, right? If you look at the left, you'll see there's 64,935 units affordable to them, right? So a shortage of, not looking at what's available, but just an absolute shortage of close to 26,000 units. When you look at just at this income group, which is between 30% and 50% AMI, you'll see there's close to 50,000 renters, right? But there's 116,000 units that are priced for households at this level, or priced at a price at which households could afford at this level. Does that make sense? So you see that there's a lot more units priced at this level than there are households, if you were trying to match people up with their incomes by the apartments that they could afford, right?
Andrew, you want to go back to the previous slide because it kind of re-emphasizes, you can see it visually in two different ways then.
Right, right.
The right-hand side.
Right, which is the shortage significantly declines as the income goes up, even up to 50% of AMI, the shortage significantly declines. And so, and that's what, you know, if you were to look at ELI plus VLI, there's actually a surplus of 41,000 units. Now, some of them would be occupied by higher income households. And you'll see here this top group, there's 92,000 renters who would not be considered low income. They have incomes above 80% of AMI. And there's units that are affordable to them, very few. But in actuality, most of these households, you know, obviously are choosing to occupy units that are much more affordable to them. And so at the coalition, this is what we are most concerned about. And we spent, starting in the late 1990s, we started an advocacy campaign for the National Housing Trust Fund. I was not there, of course, at the time. I was in Pittsburgh. But anyway, the campaign to fund it, to create a National Housing Trust Fund, that a dedicated source of revenue would go into that fund, and then that fund would help to be used to provide affordable housing for extremely low-income households. About 10 years later, probably took about a decade, the National Housing Trust Fund was actually enacted by the Housing and Economic Recovery Act in 2008, and it was intended to be funded. It has a dedicated source of revenue based on the volume of business that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do. So the fund was actually created in 2008, the dedicated source of revenue from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. After the act was passed, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac wound up in conservatorship with the federal government, and the requirement for them to put money into the fund was suspended by the FHFA. That suspension was lifted at the end of 2014, and so for 2015, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been required to set aside funds for the National Housing Trust Fund that will be hopefully distributed in the summer of 2016. So in 2016 will be the first year that money will be available from the trust fund. Sorry. The trust fund, it's about 0.04% of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's volume of business they set aside to go into the trust fund. Based on the volume that they've had so far this year, we estimate that next year they will have payments into the trust fund that will be distributed of about $198 billion, so close to 200. That's our estimate. That money will be distributed to states, and the money has to be used at least 90% of it. Well, there's a certain exception right now, which I'll get to in a minute. But typically, 90% of that money needs to be used for rental housing. Up to 10% can be used for homeownership housing. 75% of the money has to be used for ELI households to benefit extremely low-income households. up to a quarter of it can be used to benefit very low-income households. At the moment, however, as part of HUD's interim role, I think it's part of it. Sometimes I get confused between the role and the statute. But anyway, at the moment, I think it's the interim role. I did mention I'm not on the policy team, right? So I get confused when they talk about roles and statutes and all these different policy terminology. But anyway, at the moment, if the fund has less than $1 billion in a year, or if it's funded at less than $1 billion, all of the money has to be used to benefit extremely low-income households. So if it's funded next year at about $196 million, all of it has to be used for ELI renters. Could be homeownership too, but to benefit ELI households. And so at the moment, that's the situation that we're in. To give some sense about what we were, about the thought when the act was enacted. In 2008, when the National Housing Trust Fund was created, had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had to put funds into the fund based on their volume of that year, it would have been $1 billion. So the volume has declined to such an amount that actually it being funded. So, you know, at one time when the fund was created, you know, there was an estimate that it would be about $1 billion. Instead, now that when it is actually being funded, 6 years later, the first year at least, it'll be about, well, close to $200 million. If our estimates are correct. Oh, wrong way. How it is set to be distributed is each state plus DC will receive a minimum of $3 million. We don't believe we have to worry about this, but if the trust fund, if it does not have sufficient funds to give $3 million to each state in D.C., so if it's not more than $153 million, then HUD needs to publish an alternative method of how they're going to distribute the money. We don't believe that that's going to be an issue, though, that each state will get $3 million in D.C. plus D.C., and then the remaining is distributed to states based on a formula. And the formula is based solely on the rental market and the need for ELI, need for rental units for extremely low income and very low income renters. Those are the only factors that go into the formula for the additional allocation. And so the formula is based on the size of the shortage in each state of rental properties that are affordable and available to ELI and BLI households. It's based on the number of ELI and BLI renter households who are severely cost burdened, and we always talk about the shortage and severe cost burdens, and so the number that are severe cost burdened. And then the priority, there's also a weighted priority, the need for ELI households is weighted at 75%, so much more emphasis is given to the need for ELI households. And so it's important to realize that, you know, that even the formula is based solely on the rental market, the rental units, and extremely low-income and very low-income renters. I'm going to, if anyone has questions, I can come back to this slide. I realized I put the wrong slide in. This is what our estimate was about what each state would get, but we did it at the beginning of the year before we had any idea what might be distributed. So we used $250 million. In reality, it's going to be closer to $200 million. If it's $200 million, 28 states will get the minimum $3 million, and the others will get more than $3 million. This is based on $250 million, so I put the red wrong slide in. But that's the problem when you keep, you know, making different slides that all look the same. But if it was 250, Pennsylvania, we estimated we'd get 7.2 million. That would be less now, because we think it would be closer to 200 million. And then, at the moment, each state must first identify which agency will be responsible for distributing the funds. In Pennsylvania, I believe it's the Florida, Pennsylvania Finance. Forgot where I was for a second. It'll be the Pennsylvania Finance Housing Finance Agency, PHFA. And they must come up with an allocation plan of how they will distribute these funds, how they will fund projects. the allocation plan must give priority to certain things, and I have the six of those things listed up here. One is geographic diversity, which when it's such a small amount of money is not going to be as much of an issue. That'll be more of an issue probably when, if you know, there's a lot more money that's being distributed, then geographic diversity will probably be more important. The extent that rents are affordable to ELI renters, the length of time that the apartments will be kept affordable, the current requirement is 30 years, but if it's longer, priority should be given to longer time. And then the merit, so the merit of the project, meaning, the merits of the project, and HUD gives some examples of, you know, does it serve people with special needs, energy saving, is it accessible to employment centers or transit, merit, that type of merit should also be given priority. And we have been at the coalition, we've been working at the, you know, at the federal level, we have been very, I have been very hard putting numbers together, but the policy team and the field team have been working very hard on protecting the trust fund because it's constantly under threat of some people wanting to abolish the trust fund or defund it. There's been the threat of now reducing home funds because, oh no, you have the National Housing Trust Fund money, so you don't need home money, which is currently being used for affordable housing programs. And so really a lot of our work at the moment is protecting all of what currently exists plus the Housing Trust Fund. And there's a campaign called the Campaign for Housing and Community Development Funding that is a group of 44 national organizations, many of them I think are based in DC, that are keeping their eye on this. So they include like us and Enterprise, NeighborWorks, LISC, and many others, with the sole goal of that group to protect the federal government, the federal money that exists for housing and community development, and because there's so many threats against it. We don't get into specifics with that group only because, you know, some groups want vouchers, other groups want more community development funds, and so we all want the money for different things. But we all realize that, you know, the financial resources are constrained. So we're doing that at the federal level. But we really feel like required allocation plans that now is the time that at the state level advocates need to start becoming involved if they're not already involved and thinking about the allocation plans and what they will be like and how they will be set up. And basically how will the trust fund be implemented, because it's really, a lot of it is left to the states on how they're going to implement. How are they going to decide to distribute the money, and how will the money be used, in what way, which is very much a question at the moment, is how will it best be used? The coalition, of course, we want to try to use it as effectively as possible for ELI renters. Other people have different opinions on that.
So does that mean so it could be used for development of units or for rental assistance?
It can be, it can be used for rental assistance. So it can be used in a variety of ways, and that's up to the states to decide. Yeah. So some of the areas that I think that we feel in the development of the allocation plans at the state level that are important to get input on really deal with the extent that the rents are affordable, the length of time that the apartments will be affordable, and number four, you know, the merits of the project. What really are the needs and the special needs in that state, right? The National Housing Trust Fund itself does not require rents to be capped at 30% of a resident's income. They don't have to be brook rents. For those of you familiar with housing policy, brook rents are rents that are tied to the household's income, so the household doesn't spend more than 30% of their income on rent, right? The trust fund money does not have to be set up, does not have to be used in that way. The trust fund money, rents, using funds from the trust fund, rents can be set at 30% of the income limit for ELI. So for a four-person household in Pittsburgh, that's, you know, something that's affordable to someone making $20,910. Or 30% of the poverty threshold, whichever is higher. So if, for example, a unit using funds from the trust fund is the rent can be set at 30% of the ELI income limit. But if my income is only half of that, 15% of the area median income, let's say it's only like $10,000 a year, I will be cost burdened because the rent is actually set higher than what I can afford based on the 30% standard. And very similar to, you know, other home programs of LIHTC that they work the same way as well. And so, you know, we would like to see find a way, of course, to use that language in the allocation plan. We recognize it is very difficult, but we would like to see that language in the allocation of the plan that says, you know, one of the priorities is the extent to which units are affordable, is to try to encourage states to find a way to have it, to have the rents in some instances lower than 30% of 30% of AMI. And Pennsylvania is actually a state that does that to some extent because of the requirement and the tax credits in Pennsylvania that some units, I think it's what, 10% of tax credit units in urban areas, 5% in rural areas, have to be priced at, I think it's 20% AMI. So, you know, states have found a way to do this. The challenge is going to become which way, you know, what's effective and getting the word out about, you know, there are effective ways to do this and learning about more ways to do that. I mean, Pennsylvania has a pretty decent program on the set aside in operating funds or operating reserves to help pay for the units over time. We also feel, of course, that advocacy should revolve around about extending the affordability period as part of the allocation plan from 30 years to something much longer. Our regulation guide says 50 years. And then the other concern that often comes up is the concern about the cost of providing rental units to extremely low-income renters. Because they're, from an operating viewpoint, they're obviously more expensive to provide because the people occupying those units can't afford to pay as much rent. And somehow you have to make up the difference in that cost between what the household can afford to pay and what it costs to maintain and operate that unit. And we recognize that that's a challenge, but we feel that there are examples of where that is happening around the country. Pennsylvania is one example. North Carolina is an example. Illinois is another example. We have found some developers that by reducing their debt obligation and their debt service, that they then put that additional savings into ELI units. So there are ways that it has been done. The challenge is to take those ways and make more people more aware about them. And there's an organization in Boston called the Technical Assistance Collaborative. They focus a lot more on supportive housing and housing for people with disabilities, but they have been looking at this about how best to use the trust fund money for ELI renters. The coalition is starting to do this as well by talking to developers and getting them together and trying to, you know, what seems to be working for them and then how do we disseminate the information to show people that this can be done, but recognizing it is a significant, it's a challenge, but it is doable. And we feel that over time, won't be right away, but over time, we'll have ways to use the, we'll find successful ways to create ELI units from the trust fund. Given that, of course, original estimates were much higher when the trust fund was created about how much money would go into it, you know, $200 million distributed nationally is not a lot of money. $3 million is not a lot of money. For housing, and so we're trying to find additional ways to fund the trust fund. A large campaign that you'll notice the logo is different here than the coalition. The campaign that the coalition started a while ago, which is now sort of taken off, is the United for Homes campaign. And what we're proposing is that, and so far more than 2,200 organizations have endorsed it. When we go for endorsements for policy, we try to get endorsements by elected officials and organizations. And so we have organizations at the national level, multi-state level, regional level, local level, and elected officials. Anyway, from all congressional districts that endorse this campaign. And basically what we are proposing is that we have mortgage interest deduction reform, which is starting to get more attention in Washington now. I don't really want to get into specifics of tax policy, but to make it short and to the point, currently mortgages, if you have a mortgage, you're eligible to take the interest that you pay on your mortgage up to $1 million in the mortgage. You can deduct as a deductible item on your tax return. we are proposing to reduce that $1 million cap on the size of mortgage that's eligible for that to $500,000. That in itself would save about $98 billion over 10 years. And then we also propose to modify the deduction. As it is, since it's a deduction, there's a lot of homeowners that do not take advantage of the mortgage interest deduction because they don't itemize on their tax returns because it's not in their interest to itemize. And so you have a lot of lower income, moderate to lower income households that cannot take advantage of the mortgage interest deduction. So we are proposing to change it from a deduction to a 15% tax credit. And so you would have 14 million more homeowners that would actually benefit from something having to do with their mortgage interest. And those additional people that we benefit are people that we often talk about. We want to help them build their wealth and, you know, by going into home ownership. In total, it would produce about $213 billion in new rent revenue over 10 years. So we have three steps to this. One step, lower the cap on eligible mortgages. Two, modify the deduction to a tax credit. Three, the $213 billion over 10 years that saves should go into the National Housing Trust Fund. The endorsers of the campaign are on board with all three of those. There are a number of other people who are starting to talk a lot more about lowering the mortgage cap. Paul Ryan, the new Speaker of the House, is one of them who has publicly said he supports lowering the cap to $500 million. He, of course, you know, does not go on to say the savings should go to affordable housing, so the next step is to try to steer that conversation that's evolving around the mortgage interest deduction back to those savings should. I mean, we should have housing policy that serves the needs of people who need housing. That's sort of our point. And so this is a campaign that the coalition has started to help fund the trust fund. And I think I'm going to set these a couple of minutes for questions. So,
okay.
Is that
good? Okay.
And the other thing I want to point out too when you ask questions is I have actually three contact people up there, so I assume my slides will be made available.
Yeah,
the slides put
on,
up online? Okay.
Yeah.
So the last slide are three contact people that, you know, you should feel free to contact the coalition at any time. I did mention we are a membership organization, so you're welcome to become members if you want. But even if you're not members, we'd like to help people out. So, you know, feel free, you know, if you have a question, feel free to call me. Ed Gramlich is actually, he's sort of our regulation guru, and so he has been traveling around the country all this fall talking about the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule and the trust fund. He's been all over the place. He's kind of hard to keep track of at the moment. And then Linda is our senior vice president for policy, and she's the one who's always on Capitol Hill. And so, you know, you should feel free to contact us if you have a policy question or a research question or And that's a good segue to say, so I might say, if you ask me a question, I might say, I'll have to talk to Ed about that.
And when you do ask a question, identify yourself and your organization, because that'll be helpful for Andrew. Okay, let's open up the floor for anyone's questions. David?
Yeah, I'm David Weber. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for the Housing Authority. I'm wondering, when you talk about available units, where does that data come from, and do you take out the substandard units that we know are
right? So we do not take out the substandard units. So number of units that would be affordable and available probably are some of them would be substandard. We don't adjust for that. So the numbers that I showed today, we take from the American Community Survey, the PUMS data, which is actually micro data, so it's the responses of every survey, of individual survey participants. So we actually identify the income of that person, whether they're extremely low income, very low income, not low income. We also identify the price of the unit they're living in, whether it's a price at ELI or BLI or low income or not low income. So we go through that process ourselves. We follow the same methodology that HUD uses in their CHAZ data, their Comprehensive Housing Affordability Strategy data, where they do the same thing. They just categorize the people for you, you know. But we use the CHAZ data for our congressional district numbers. But for just reasons of availability and timeliness, for the state numbers and for the regional numbers that I showed, we use the ACS data because it comes out more regularly and more timely than the CHAZ data does from HUD.
And that's what we think the housing agency will use in each state to figure out where, how it fits within the trust fund guidelines.
Sorry?
So there was something in the trust fund guidelines that was saying you got to use this information to figure out what the need is, so they're going to use that same data, presumably.
Right, so where I showed these numbers, so there's a formula. Well, let me just go to the right. So there's a formula that is spelled out in the Federal Register about how to calculate how much a state should get. Of course, then it's bumped up to 3 million if it's less than 3 million, and the adjustments are made. But it's based on this, the number of affordable and available units, the number of the house of extremely low income, very low income renters that are cost burdened. And then the weight, 75% to ELI renters and 25% to VLI, very low income renters. Those numbers come from the CHAZ. I have to go back and check my memory. I think those numbers come from the CHAZ data. And it's specified where those numbers have to come from. And I believe it's the CHAZ data. And the numbers that we came up with when we do our estimates come from the CHAZ data. The affordability requirement.
And I was just curious about, it made me think like, yeah, well, so what are the long-term implications? How do you see, you know, it's like we want to promote housing stability because we think that will improve outcomes, but then I guess I'm kind of curious about how you see that moving forward.
So how to do it, you mean, or how
well,
it's done?
I guess why 30 years? And
right, that's a good question. So the history of housing, So over time, in housing policy, with various programs, there's a number of programs, low-income housing tax credit, you know, at the local level, some inclusionary zoning programs like Montgomery County and elsewhere, we have learned that, if the affordability is 10 years or 15 years, the question becomes, what happens after that? And so advocates get very concerned when an affordability period is starting to expire, because if it's in a high-demand area, high opportunity area, there's a good chance that those units are going to be lost from the affordable housing stock because whoever the owner is has an incentive to not keep those units affordable, or to price them at a rate that would not be affordable. And so, you know, you've seen some programs over time increase their affordability limits. You know, like, I mean, I do. Sabina mentioned that I used to work in Montgomery County. So Montgomery County, with their inclusionary zoning program, years ago, decades ago, when they started, their first affordability period was 10 years. And after about 5 or 6 years, they realized they had a problem, that those units were no longer going to be affordable. And so they increased the affordability time for new units to 15 years, and then 20 years. Now, I have to admit it's a little crazy, but now it's 99 years in Montgomery County, inclusionary zoning units that are required to be affordable at 65% AMI have to be kept affordable for 99 years, which, how you predict what's going to happen 100 years from now, I have no idea. But some of the 99 years, that was a political decision because it made people look very good because it's such a concern. I'm expressing now the views of mine. I don't know if I'm expressing the views of the coalition. But, you know, any number of years that's chosen is kind of arbitrary because you don't know what a market or what's going to be happening 50 years from now, even 30 years from now. But we do know that, you know, we're going through this now with rural housing programs that received 515, well, a mortgage program from rural development that are now maturing. And there's a huge concern because there's this need for this affordable housing to be kept affordable. But once the mortgages mature, they don't have to be kept affordable. And that was, I think, 30 years ago. And here we are now 30 years later and we have a problem because these units are maybe lost from the affordable housing stock. Section 8 projects the same way, you know, and those contracts expire. And so we have learned that, yeah, we can't predict, you know, 30 years from now or 50 years from now what's going to be happening. But we know from experience that from programs we have had that 30 years, when the 30 years is up, we're still worrying about what to do with those programs. Now the question becomes, though, how do you have a mechanism in place to help finance those units for 30 years and even 50 years? And we are exploring ways to do that, but you know, we have to find ways.
Thea Young, I'm a member of the Building Inclusive Communities Coalition, work with the Southwestern Pennsylvania Housing Alliance. Well, there are people here who can talk more about this, but there's an effort in Pittsburgh to look at using community land trusts, developing community land trusts in the area. Looking at a hub and spoke kind of mechanism where there's a central supporting operating body providing technical assistance and administration to other local land trusts that would be developed in the area in neighborhoods that express interest in supporting those. So that's one way to
land trust, meaning so the trust owns the land.
Yes.
And the occupant of the house owns the house or eventually.
Well,
the house.
It can also be for rental.
Okay.
It can be for rental.
Because mm-hmm. the thought behind them is if you control the cost of the land, if you control the land,
yeah.
I mean, the price of housing is the price of the land and the price of the construction. And if you have a nonprofit or a land trust that captures the price of the land,
yeah.
then you can try to keep the housing affordable. So we don't get involved too much with community land trusts, but there's a national organization that does. I think it's called the National Community Land Trust. Or that sounds too simple. Is that what it's called? I mean, I know some people are there. Yeah. Well, we're the National Low Income Housing Coalition, so that seems kind of a simple title. So national, yeah, community land trust. So they, I mean, they'd be very familiar with various models of how that's done. I mean, one of our concerns, I'm glad you said rental, you know, one of our concerns with ELI households is very rarely would they have the resources for home ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't look at home ownership programs at all at the coalition. Mostly because, you know, the population that we're most concerned about, we don't see a good way for them to be homeowners. So that's financially viable. And so we haven't really gotten in to home. We don't get into home ownership policies. Yeah, but and we haven't looked at community land trusts in terms of renters. The National Community Land Trust would be the place to go.
Yeah.
Oops,
first.
Yeah.
Have you guys looked at, or do you spend any time looking at where the housing is? So, you know, making sure that people aren't being forced into regions that are just extremely poor, because that just creates, you know, I mean, that creates a different set of problems. I mean, obviously, people need to have a place to live, but, you know, there are other things to bringing a community, and when you put a lot of extremely poor people in the same place, you know, it changes the dynamics of the place. And so is that a part of the work that you do?
To an extent, yes. And I'll explain now. I'll explain currently how we're thinking about
other communities
right.
that maybe are you know, not necessarily affluent communities, but communities that are middle-income communities understand that responsible, affordable housing, when done well, is a good thing. It's not. I mean, is that a part of what you guys look at and talk about and think about?
It is. Well, I'll explain how, because I don't know if it's in the way that you are referring to, but it is. And so. You know, our primary concern at the moment is constantly battling to make sure that money is available to produce units and to provide affordable units. And so that is a lot of what we focus on. Having said that, with the new affirmatively furthering fair housing rule that HUD has issued, you know, we obviously think that that's a very good rule. I mean, but one of our policy goals is that low-income households should have access to stable housing in places of their choice. And so what that means is there should be opportunities to develop affordable housing in places that currently do not have affordable housing. But the flip side of that, though, is that, you know, that should not, investment in housing in other places, so in terms of like for community redevelopment, should not be opposed because, oh, we have to spend all the money in places where affordable housing does not exist. And so somewhere in there is a balance because we feel that people should have choice. The other way that we're concerned is one thing I did not mention today is in partnership with another organization called PARC, which is the Public and Affordable Housing Research Corporation, which is a nonprofit subsidiary of a research company, actually, that insures public housing authorities. We jointly maintain the National Housing Preservation Database, which is a database of all the federally subsidized housing units and properties in the country. And expiration times of when contracts will expire for those properties. And there's been a lot of concern, of course, preserving those units as expiration periods come up. What we have not done, but what is on our work plan with PARC over the next year or two, is how do we help advocates identify where properties are most likely to be lost? And so, for example, I can go to this database and I can say, I'm making these numbers up because I didn't look it up, but. And, you know, we can say, oh, you know, 2,000 units, Section 8 units, for example, are going to expire over the next 5 years in some county, right? But that does not mean that all 2,000 units are really at significant risk of being lost. There are some units that have characteristics that make them more likely to be lost. And so with limited funds, should we focus on certain properties that are more likely to be lost? And that takes identifying the location of these properties in the surrounding neighborhood and the ownership, because we know that ownership structure influences whether a property is likely to be lost. We know that the type of neighborhood that the property is in, the age of the property, and who is in that property. And so can we take those factors and come up with a better estimate than, oh, 2,000 units are going to be lost because the expiration period is up, and instead say, you know, what we should really be concerned about is these 500 units that are located here because maybe, you know, it's a high opportunity neighborhood with good schools, or you know, an employment center has grown close by, has grown up close by.
So you manage address level data at the national level?
We do.
That's impressive.
We do. And then the data comes from HUD. Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. So one of the things, well, yeah, we do.
That's impressive.
Which is funny. We take HUD's data, clean it up, and then make it available back to PDNR, which is the research team of HUD. So we help each, I mean, we are advocates, and we oppose HUD on many things, but we also work together on many things as well. And data is one of the things that we work together pretty well.
It's kind of similar, but I'm, okay, so my name is Zeba Ahmed, and I work at the Northside Leadership Conference, and I am the Vacant Structures Coordinator, so my job is to deal with vacant buildings. So one of the things I was thinking is, like, because of the issues with affordable housing and these are the affordability period, like, when those units are lost, what happens? So, like, obviously, it's not sustainable to keep building more and more units as they gradually expire. But we also want to avoid, like, because, for example, in a neighborhood that stays low income, that affordable units might stay that way, and then you end up with, like, a concentration of poverty. But in neighborhoods that have large numbers of vacant buildings, but also have a potential to improve their housing market, is, like, for example, rehabbing those vacant buildings into affordable housing a potential option, and is there data available to kind of support that?
To support?
To support
So you have vacant buildings that you want to rehab.
Yeah, well, see,
to affordable housing.
Yeah, the, one of the problems is that affordable renters of affordable housing tend to have a bad reputation. So a lot of the neighborhoods who have traditionally had slumlords or, you know, people, just like people who have not been pre-screened or whatever, they're like, well, we're going to, redo the real estate, but we don't want those kind of rentals in our neighborhood anymore. We want stability. We want good homeowners. So then it's a little bit complicated because, like, they had affordable housing, but now they want to redevelop to have homeownership because it's more stable and safer.
So I'm gonna go into an area where I'm not sure if I'm completely accurate, but Sabina will correct me. Probably if I'm wrong. But you know, it was interesting. So when I was in Pittsburgh, and Sabina said I worked for COPSI, we were working in a neighborhood, Hazelwood neighborhood, and we were looking at the quality of the housing stock. And the residents there were so opposed to Section 8, to vouchers. We don't want vouchers in this neighborhood. We don't want vouchers in this neighborhood. There's going to be those people here. Landlords don't take care of the properties. But I think that what's interesting about that, and I think Sabina pointed this out at the time too, if you have a voucher, the unit is inspected.
Yeah.
Right? And so you would think that there's a mechanism in place that actually would be better housing than housing that's just being left go in the neighborhood. Am I right or am I wrong?
What we found when I was in MBI was we actually had the County Housing Authority come out and meet with us for Braddock and North Braddock and East Pittsburgh and say, what are your complaints? What are the units that you're complaining about? Give me the addresses. None of them were subsidized properties. They were private landlords. So it's an issue of having landlord legislation so that you're licensing the units, so that you're monitoring the units with the building inspection and the licensing fees for the building inspection. So you're regulating those unsubsidized landlords so that they're taking care of their property.
I knew someone in the audience would have
it. George, identify yourself and tell everyone.
I sit no longer.
Yeah, tell everyone about your connection.
George
here.
Moses, former chair of the National Loan Commission. Cut my teeth with these folks and others in this room. Again, what you're saying is pretty relevant, really true. But as a person who grew up in both public housing and Section 8 privately owned subsidized housing, some of that monitoring and everything that you talk about that might be in place now did not exist some time ago. It did not exist in the buildings in East Liberty. The high rises is knocked down. I lived there. I used to read the inspection report every year. They said they inspected my unit. They never came to my unit. So again, as we have changed over the course of time, just remember one thing. A lot of properties are done, they're inspected by contractors. And contractors are paid to do this work. Sometimes they do it good, sometimes they do it bad. My friend Dave and here we go back a long time and everything, Whitney. So there's a lot of issues. And when you think about things, concentrated poverty, is it that bad? I mean, I grew up in concentrated poverty. Never knew I was poor. Many folks came out of those neighborhoods, went on to be tons of things. So when we talk about relevance and what is it, there's a whole lot of, and Ralph can speak to this, a lot of outside issues that come into play. So you can't just talk about one without talking about a bunch of others. I work for a health company now, and I always talk about health and housing. They run together. And so when you think about doing things, and you think about, as my colleague has brilliantly laid out, you just have to be mindful that everything is in its own time. We lost so many units here in the city of Pittsburgh, it is unbelievable. And so we're always playing catch up. And it's always the poor folks that are playing catch up. And so as we do this, and these conversations are going to continue forever, I just appreciate the dialogue and see the young people in the room, because this will affect you as you go along. I mean, we talk about East Liberty, how nice it's becoming. And once upon a time when the towers were in East Liberty, the homeowners and the renters that lived in Highland Park didn't, oh yeah, let it go, let it go. But now what has come into Bakery Square has increased their values, increased everything, that now they're finding out the affordability for them is hurt, is tough. So now they're saying, can you help us, can you help us? So you just gotta be careful what you wish for in the long run. You know what I mean? And it has to be done in a good way. I think the Housing Authority, they've done some good things, some bad things. But they're working at it. At least they have a forum where you can actually go talk to them. And you can sit down and communicate with them. And with the work that the school social work and Ralph has done around a lot of things, it's been very good. You know what I mean? Our relationship with HUD now is a lot better than it used to be, both at the national and state level. And so you gotta look at housing, transportation, health. You gotta look all of those things together to be able to formulate a community that you would like to see. Because most folks like me wanna stay where I grew up at. When we do elderly housing, they wanna stay there. They don't wanna move way over there. They wanna stay right here. So you gotta look at that, folks. You know what I mean? You gotta understand that. I apologize for being late, being mouthy, but this is what we're doing. I love you to death. We're a membership organization. Please take a membership. Join.
There you go.
Get that data. And everything else. So,
he did a better sales job than I did. Yeah.
George,
that's
you never have
our,
to apologize.
That's why he was our chair.
Never, never. Well, I'm glad, you got in. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad
yeah,
you, yeah. Thanks
yeah,
for
yeah.
everything. That's a real treat for a lot of folks who are kind of new to the area to have, and new to the Low Income Housing Coalition to have George here in the audience too. I've got a quick question. Is there a question back there? I've got a quick question, Andrew. And, go ahead.
I just had a quick question. My name is Annette Kay. I'm from the Policy Center of Duquesne.
Okay.
And I'm kind of piggybacking off of George's comments, is what kind of interagency collaboration and communication is there? Because there are so many federal programs that provide all kinds of housing assistance for renters, for homeowners, for land rehabilitation, and it seems like there's a lot of good work going out there in all kinds of different divisions, HUD, HFA, wherever, and how's this all working, or is it not working?
In my opinion.
Yeah. I don't realize it's a policy question. I don't want to freak you out. But.
No. So, I've only been in the coalition for about 6 months. I started in July. This is only the second talk I've given under the name of the coalition. And the last one just was a bunch just to a group called the Housing Statistics Users Group. And so this group is much more interesting question. So this is based on 6 months of observations in my opinion. You know, there is surprisingly, there's a lot of communication in DC among all these different groups. And we have a pretty full calendar of conference calls among all these groups. And the one at the moment is I mentioned it briefly, the campaign for housing and community development funding, which includes us, the National Alliance to End Homelessness, Enterprise List, NeighborWorks, a whole bunch of different other advocacy organizations. And the commonality, the trick is finding a common stand, and so you provide a unified voice to Congress as well as to all the state coalition partners. And the one common stance for that group is that we have to protect the federal funding for housing and community development. And, you know, we have the viewpoint of that funding is most important for extremely low-income renters. You know, the Center for Budget and Policy and Center on Budget Policy and Priorities, their view is what's most important is the money for vouchers, you know. Some other view is what's most important is the money for, you know, something else, you know. Home funds are very important, you know. We may disagree on the specifics of where the money should go, but what we all agree on is there has to be money to do this housing work. And so we do all come together, and I think there's a phone call every other week where all these organizations get on the phone, we sit in the conference room. Well, some of them actually come to our conference room where we go to their conference room, but it's either in person or on the phone, and they talk about, okay, what's happening now in terms of the budget? What's happening now in terms of what we're hearing from other from federal agencies? Just to keep everyone on the same page. And so in that regard, there is a lot of communication. There also is, you know, obviously some disagreement on where investments should go, and on specific policies and specific programs, there's disagreement. I mean, there's generally good communication, at least that's my impression, and we all work together pretty well. You know, we work closely with the Alliance Against Homelessness, you know, because their view and our view is, you know, if you don't have ELI, if you don't have housing for extremely low-income households, and they have an emergency come up in their life, and they're severely cost-burdened, what happens? If they don't have family to rely on, they become homeless. Mm-hmm. And so we have a close connection with the National Alliance Against Homelessness, because we have that overlapping. How do you provide stable housing? Mm-hmm. You know, we don't get into the things that they do, you know, provide housing, provide services to the homeless, but we're all on the same page. The general goal. Does that, I don't know if I'm really answering your question.
Yeah, yes, it does. I mean, you said that there is communication, interagency communication, and that's
yeah.
What I was kind of wondering, how all of this works together with all of the programs that are out there. And it is hard to manage. Anybody in social work knows that case management is complex. And so I was just wondering if your thoughts were.
You know, and sometimes, you know, we even, I think sometimes by accident add to that confusion. You know, we have our state coalition partners, you know, but state coalitions also work with other national organizations. And so, you know, how we have us, you know, advocating for one thing, but they also get help from another national organization who says something else. And so it does sometimes cause a little bit of confusion.
And that's a good
but
question.
In the end, on the broader question, we are on the same page of the end goal.
I'll take the chair's prerogative for the last question here, Andrew, because it builds on that with the partnerships and particularly what George Moses was talking about. A lot of folks, and particularly difference between maybe rural, extremely low income, and urban, in the sense of access and transportation. Lots of folks who are extremely low income have a disability. They need to be close or within transportation. Relocating to far extremes becomes incredibly more difficult in the sense that they aren't automobile owners or in many of them aren't drivers. How is the coalition working with particularly transit-challenged places like, I'll say, Pittsburgh, in terms of forming those partnerships to help in whatever might be a relocation of existing extremely low-income people in terms of subsidized housing? And what the potential is going forward for the coalition in the future as the issue could compound?
That's a really good question. So what immediately comes to mind in terms of rural housing is right across the street from us is the national organization called the Housing Assistance Council, and they focus on rural affordable housing policy. They also provide technical assistance as well. But in terms of transportation in rural communities?
In urban too.
Oh, in urban too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. What could we do? Let me answer what could we do. And I think what we could do is we probably could advocate possibly better in terms of, like National Housing Trust and allocation plans, for example, is focusing more on the special merit priorities, and so access to transit, access to jobs. We have given far more attention just to the number of units because the shortage is so vast that we have focused on the number of units. We could, that's a great question. We should probably work with other advocates to encourage that to be discussed more and worked into allocation plans and even into policy at the federal level. We would have to use we would have to partner with other organizations like the Housing Assistance Council, actually there's a group, the Technical Assistance Collaborative that I mentioned on my last slide. They focus on those types of issues, housing for people with disabilities. They do a lot of advocacy work. I think we'd have to work with other organizations.
We'll let George have the last word then.
Oh, no.
Did you have a comment on that question?
No, I was just going to say you're absolutely right because I think the last, the last HUD secretary and Secretary of Transportation LaHood, they always put forth the whole thing of talking together. They were trying to get the Director of Health and Human Services in that whole dialogue conversation about how do we find our commonalities with what, especially with what was going on a lot with choice neighborhoods and other developments that constituted transportation, health issues, and other things. So they were bringing folks in. I think the challenge is get through this whole policy that divides us, you know, this and that, that separates us, and find out the common places that they can work together in making that happen, and which has always been the challenge, policy. Policies sometimes are created up here, asked to enact down here, and they totally miss each other. So having better understanding at the national level where they're talking, and at the local level where the conversation is still continuing, makes it a lot easier to form those partnerships that we were talking about. I think Dave and them tried an excellent job on their choice neighborhoods in Larimer, bringing in transportation, education, you know, all the pieces together to sort of figure out, okay, how's this all going to interact? They had some challenges and everything maybe didn't go just right, but at least they were trying to. But again, the policy sort of prohibit them sometimes from doing what they would have loved to do because of the policy and everything. And guidelines. You gotta get it done by 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Can I add one thing to that?
Okay,
the story was talking, it did occur to me that, you know, the one thing that we do is to have different interests, you know, represented, people with different viewpoints in the coalition. Our board consists of 6 of the people on our board are public housing residents from various places in the country, and so they bring a certain viewpoint. We have a representative from a national disabilities organization, and she's constantly reminding the staff about, it's not just about housing, it's about accessible housing. We have another person in housing and disabilities. And so, you know, that at least keeps us informed about what we also need to focus on. I don't know, other than the supply of housing, it reaches the staff all the time, but the discussion is there.
Okay. I want to thank you, Andrew. This is great. Thank you, everybody. Have a good holiday season. We'll be back in January. So, again, thank you all for coming.